from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Despite the media and political speculation that surrounds the Thursday attack on Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, which took the lives of almost 200 people, the fact-finding has just begun. But regardless of who actually fired the missile that downed the plane, whether the U.S.-allied Ukrainian military or pro-Russian self-defense forces or Russia itself, it's clear that in the eyes of the U.S., that Russia is to blame. At least, that's the view of political talking heads from Hillary Clinton to John McCain and of U.S. media outlets from MSNBC to Fox. Although the investigation has yet to take place, President Barack Obama Friday morning appeared to lay the blame squarely with Russia.
Yesterday, Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 took off from Amsterdam and was shot down over Ukraine near the Russian border. Nearly 300 innocent lives were taken. Men, women, children, infants who had nothing to do with the crisis in Ukraine. Their deaths are an outrage of unspeakable proportions. We know at least one American citizen, Quinn Lucas Schantzman, was killed. Our thoughts and prayers are with his family for this terrible loss. Yesterday, I spoke with the leaders of Ukraine, Malaysia, and the Netherlands. I told them that our thoughts and prayers are with all the families and that the American people stand with them during this difficult time. Later today, I'll be speaking with Prime Minister Abbott of Australia, which also suffered a terrible loss. And by far, the country that lost the most people on board the plane was the Netherlands. From the days of our founding, the Dutch have been close friends and stalwart allies of the United States of America, and today I want the Dutch people to know that we stand with you shoulder to shoulder in our grief and in our absolute determination to get to the bottom of what happened. Now, here's what we know so far. Evidence indicates that the plane was shot down by a surface-to-air missile that was launched from an area that is controlled by Russian-backed separatists inside of Ukraine. We also know that this is not the first time a plane has been shot down in eastern Ukraine. Over the last several weeks, Russian-backed separatists have shot down a Ukrainian transport plane and a Ukrainian helicopter, and they claimed responsibility for shooting down a Ukrainian fighter jet. Moreover, we know that these separatists have received a steady flow of support from Russia. This includes arms and training. It includes heavy weapons, and it includes anti-aircraft weapons. Now, here's what must happen now. This was a global tragedy. An Asian airliner was destroyed in European skies filled with citizens from many countries. So there has to be a credible international investigation into what happened. The UN Security Council has endorsed this investigation, and we will hold all its members, including Russia, to their word. In order to facilitate that investigation, Russia, pro-Russian separatists, and Ukraine must adhere to an immediate ceasefire. Evidence must not be tampered with. Investigators need to access the crash site, and the solemn task of returning those who were lost on board the plane to their loved ones needs to go forward immediately.
President Obama's remarks echoed the remarks of then-President Ronald Reagan in a speech delivered in September 1983, which may further provide a model of the U.S. response should Russia or pro-Russian forces be ultimately found to have fired the rocket.
Fellow Americans, I'm coming before you tonight about the Korean Airline massacre, the attack by the Soviet Union against 269 innocent men, women, and children aboard an unarmed Korean passenger plane. This crime against humanity must never be forgotten, here or throughout the world. Our prayers tonight are with the victims and their families in their time of terrible grief. Our hearts go out to them, to brave people like Catherine McDonald, the wife of a congressman whose composure and eloquence on the day of her husband's death moved us all. He will be sorely missed by all of us here in government. The The parents of one slain couple wired me. Our daughter and her husband died on Korean Airline Flight 007. Their deaths were the result of the Soviet Union violating every concept of human rights. The emotions of these parents, grief, shock, anger, are shared by civilized people everywhere. From around the world, press accounts reflect an explosion of condemnation by people everywhere. Let me state as plainly as I can, there was absolutely no justification, either legal or moral, for what the Soviets did. One newspaper in India said, if every passenger plane is fair game for home air forces, it will be the end to civil aviation as we know it. This is not the first time the Soviet Union has shot at and hit a civilian airliner when it overflew its territory. In another tragic incident in 1978, the Soviets also shot down an unarmed civilian airliner after having positively identified it as such. In that instance, the Soviet interceptor pilot clearly identified the civilian markings on the side of the aircraft, repeatedly questioned the order to fire on a civilian airliner, and was ordered to shoot it down anyway. The aircraft was hit with a missile and made a crash landing. Several innocent people lost their lives in this attack, killed by shrapnel from the blast of a Soviet missile. Is this a practice of other countries in the world? The answer is no. Commercial aircraft from the Soviet Union and Cuba, on a number of occasions, have overflown sensitive United States military facilities. They weren't shot down. We and other civilized countries believe in the tradition of offering help to mariners and pilots who are lost or in distress on the sea or in the air. We believe in following procedures to prevent a tragedy.
Alternatively, should the facts show that the Ukrainian military downed the plane, there may be a response like the one 5 years after Reagan's 1983 speech, when in 1988, the U.S. warship Vincennes shot down Iranian Airlines Flight 655, killing all on board. This report from RT on the anniversary of that provides some insight into a possible U.S. response.
Oh, dead! Yeah. We had him got it. That was a dead on.
At the height of the Iran-Iraq war, the USS Vincennes in the Strait of Hormuz blew up Iranian airliner 655, killing all 290 citizens on board, including nearly 70 children. At the time of the deadly incident, the U.S. Navy said it was a case of mistaken identity and believed the plane to be an F-14 fighter jet, the same ones the U.S. sold to the Shah of Iran just 10 years before.
The bold-faced lies about, you know, the plane was descending, it was approaching an altitude where it was prepared to attack us. If it was flying at that low of an altitude, it would clearly have been seen for what it was, not an F-14.
Navid, an Iranian-American, refers back to the initial investigation.
It absolutely was a cover-up, but even the cover-up itself was denied. Not only just the fact that a mistake happened, the fact that a cover-up happened to cover up the mistake was also denied.
Like millions of Iranians around the world, Navid will mark July 3rd as a day of mourning.
We're showing the Iranian government that its actions have consequences. And if it persists, the pressure will continue to mount, and its isolation will continue to deepen.
She was the mother of a U.S. student expected home for Christmas on Pan Am Flight 103.
The charred bodies of Iranian civilians floating in Iranian waters did not evoke the same reaction when the Lockerbie bombing happened just 5 months after the IR-655 incidents. Years later, the U.S. expressed deep disgust when the Lockerbie bomber was released.
The images that we saw in Libya yesterday were outrageous and disgusting.
I believe that given the operating environment, Captain Rogers acted reasonably and did what his nation expected of him in the defense of his ship and crew.
When you look, for example, at the very different responses to the Lockerbie incident as opposed to this incident, it's clear that the lives of some people are of inherently greater value than the lives of other people. And it's sad and it's unfortunate, but it's true.
The crew of the USS Vincennes was later awarded combat action medals, and the captain of the ship was awarded the Legion of Merit. No one from the USS Vincennes was ever penalized for taking down the Airbus.
The cover-up, the medals, it just speaks to a larger mentality that is at play here, which is not only can we do no wrong, but all of our actions are inherently right.
The U.S. later settled the case with the Iranians at $131 million, compared to the near $3 billion Libya paid the United States for their Lockerbie bombing.
Hi, I was calling to get general comment about an incident that took place 22 years ago. Call the State Department? So now we're on the phone with the State Department, and they say we have to call the DOD back to get a response. The DOD had originally sent us over to the Navy to the State Department. Now the State Department is sending us back to the Department of Defense.
The fact that George Bush said that, for example, I will never apologize for the U.S. no matter what the facts are, it's not even a matter of apologizing for the U.S. It's just a matter of admitting a simple wrongdoing.
And so, as the U.S. gears up to celebrate their Independence Day on the 4th of July, the Islamic Republic of Iran will be mourning 22 years since the American Navy killed nearly 300 of their people. Jahan Hafiz, RT, Washington, D.C.
U.S. allies on the Security Council also pointed their fingers at Russia during a heated emergency session Friday. RT's Marina Portnaya was there and gave this report.
Russian envoy to the UN Vitaly Churkin did urge council members from prejudging the outcome of an international investigation into the plane crash by using broad statements and insinuations that hold Russia accountable, because that's precisely what most Western countries of the Security Council did. Ambassador Churkin said there are many unanswered questions, such as why did the Ukrainian aviation dispatcher send a plane or allow a plane to enter an insecure, dangerous territory? Did Ukrainian aviation authorities do everything they could to prevent a disaster from occurring? And why didn't Ukraine close their airspace to all commercial civilian flights weeks or even months ago? Ambassador Churkin says the Ukrainian government has not been showing military restraint, as Western countries have insisted. He said, in contrary, Kyiv's aggressive attacks and indiscriminate shelling of areas in eastern Ukraine has led to more violence and clashes. And this is why Moscow insists that responsibility for the tragic plane crash lies with Kyiv.
We've repeatedly warned of the dangers of solving Ukraine's political crisis through the use of force. We've been calling for respectful dialogue between the conflicting sides. However, at each stage, Kyiv has chosen the wrong path, and their Western backers, and I'm speaking mainly of the United States, have pushed them to escalate the crisis. And now, when facing the catastrophic consequences of this course of action, they're trying to shift responsibility to Russia.
Now, U.S. officials insist that a surface-to-air missile was used to shoot down the plane. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Samantha Power says it's likely that an SA-11 was actually used specifically to down the Malaysian airliner. And the international community, she says, cannot rule out that Russian training or help for separatists in eastern Ukraine was involved in shooting down the plane. Now, many Western Council members also said that the Ukrainian separatists have shot down several planes in recent days, which establishes their record and capability of activity. The Ukrainian ambassador told the council that he believes the separatists, the anti-Kyiv separatists, are armed with two missile systems capable of shooting down a plane, such as the Malaysian Airlines plane we saw come crashing down. He insisted that his government has evidence to back up the claim. Now, the UN Security Council has expressed its condolences to the families of the plane crash victims and has also called for a full, thorough, and independent international investigation into the crash that claimed the lives of 298 innocent people. The council is also urging all parties in Ukraine to grant investigators access to the site, insisting that if any evidence has been removed, it should be immediately returned. Now, Russian President Vladimir Putin and his American counterpart Barack Obama, who we just heard speaking, have both called for an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine as the international community responds to this tragedy and actually searches for the facts and the truth. There's a lot that we still do not know about what led to this tragedy and the loss of nearly 300 lives.
But the fact-finding has just begun, and we've yet to hear from Russian and American surveillance systems in the sensitive, well-monitored region where the airliner was put down. We'll be taking note of developments over the weekend and report back on Monday. Israel began its ground invasion of Gaza, already besieged by years of blockade and many days of aerial bombardment, with hundreds already dead. We have this report from Press TV's Omar Leski.
At least one Israeli soldier is killed in the early hours of Israel's ground invasion of Gaza. Israeli sources say at least five other soldiers have been wounded. These are the first fatalities of Israel's ground incursion, which began after 10 days of intense airstrikes on the Gaza Strip. Meanwhile, Palestinian fighters fired rockets at an area near the Hof Ashkelon Regional Council in retaliation for Israeli attacks on their territory. They also targeted Dimona City in the Negev Desert. Earlier, Palestinians said they targeted a military base north of the Gaza Strip, injuring three Israeli soldiers there. The flare-up of tensions comes shortly after a temporary humanitarian truce between Hamas and Israel came to an end. Hamas officials have also rejected Israeli claims about a new ceasefire deal. Let's get more now from Hala Al-Safadi, our correspondent with us live from Gaza. Hala, first of all, tell us about the process of the ground incursion. What's happening near the border area, the buffer zone? We're hearing at least one Israeli soldier has been killed, while more than 20 Palestinians have also died.
I actually contacted people who are living, who live in Beit Hanun and Beit Lahia areas. They confirmed that the Israeli tanks and soldiers are already in residential areas. We're not reading this in the news so far, but those residents have confirmed this, the news. Basically, there is also another incursion near the Gaza airport, which was already destroyed targeted number of times since the beginning of this escalation. So now we're witnessing an incursion in North Gaza and in South Gaza as well. In South Gaza is still limited near the Gaza airport, while in Rafah, in North Gaza, in Beit Lahia and Beit Hanun, they confirmed that they're already among residents at the moment. Even though they're already in a ground invasion, we're still hearing number of explosions taking place all over the Gaza Strip. Before we came to Al-Shifa Hospital, where I'm standing right now, there was a huge explosion heard right to next to our office. The news we have so far that they've targeted a restaurant that belongs to a freed prisoner who was exiled to Gaza. So basically, airstrikes are still taking place. We're hearing a number of shelling coming from Israeli tanks as well as from gunboats. It doesn't look like it's getting any better. Actually, at the moment me speaking, there is a father who has his three-year-old son who is just right in front of my eyes. He just came out of the hospital. His son is injured and he's only 3 years old. So again, Israel continue to target civilians and causing more injuries and death in the lines of children as well. We'll try to talk to the father and hopefully we'll get an interview with him as well.
Right, hello. We're also hearing that Hamas officials have been rejecting Israeli claims about a new ceasefire deal. What can you tell us about that?
So far, Hamas did confirm that there is nothing about a ceasefire to take place. Unlike the claims that we've heard yesterday that there is a ceasefire that would start today on Friday in Gaza. They're talking about now we're actually witnessing another stage of this operation, and it doesn't seem like there would be any ceasefire after such an operation. We're talking about a ground incursion, and actually the Israel army gave this operation a new name. And once Israel gives an operation a name, it means it's serious. And it wouldn't be ending. According to an Israeli analyst, I read his article, he stated that such an operation, if it's going to continue and the ground incursion is going to keep going, basically it would be talking about a three-week operation if the army wants to destroy the tunnels and destroy the infrastructure of Hamas in Gaza Strip. So basically Hamas is still continues to respond to those Israeli attacks. A number of rockets have been launched at Ashkelon, Ashdod, and Beersheva. Also, there is a number of clashes and taking place between the Israeli occupation forces and Hamas militants and other fighters in the Gaza Strip. So the situation is escalating, this is for sure, and it doesn't seem like it's going to be a calm anytime soon.
And we have this report from Press TV's Kovi Tavwe.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas steps up its fight against Israel after Tel Aviv started its ground incursion into Gaza late Thursday. One Israeli soldier has been killed ever since. Hamas's military wing, the Al-Qassam Brigades, says that it ambushed Israeli units in the northern town of Beit Lahia and caused casualties among them. The Israeli military says some 50 rockets have been fired from Gaza at Israel since the beginning of the ground incursion. Explosions were heard in Israel's Eshkol and Sdodot Negev Regional Council. Warning sirens were also heard in Ashkelon and Sher HaNegev Regional Council. Akram Al-Sattari is a correspondent who joins us from the Gaza Strip to update us on the situation there. Well, Akram, my immediate question, aside from you updating us about the number of deaths and casualties and injuries, is on the ground operation, what are we looking at? Are Israeli soldiers, as we speak, on Gazan soil, and what are they doing?
Well, Israeli soldiers are on the Gazan soil, but in the very close areas to the buffer zone, they are conducting military activities, taking over some of the houses in the areas of Khan Yunis and the areas of Beit Hanun, targeting the people and preventing people from burying their dear who were killed when the people were overwhelmingly targeted yesterday in their homes when Israel wanted them to flee the scene, to flee from their houses. Israeli air forces are also supporting the ground forces. They are targeting the nearby areas by aerial attacks, and they are causing an increased number of fatalities. Like in the last 1 hour, we had 8 different people killed in 3 different locations in the Gaza Strip. One in the area of Al-Fukhari between Khan Yunis and Rafah. 3 people were killed, and another one in attack in Al-Nusayrat that claimed the life of 2 Palestinians, and the third attack took place in Beit Hanun area north of Gaza, where 2 people were killed, and a body of a dead man was retrieved, and the man was killed last night in an Israeli artillery fire. Technically, the Israeli fire is covering the all the buffer zone and the nearby areas, 47 kilometers area, and the Israeli troops are advancing into the Palestinian territory in the rural areas that are nearby the buffer zone.
So when Israel, who has announced that they are going to expand their ground operation, and the aim of this ground operation overall is to destroy the tunnels, and I'm assuming these are the tunnels of the Rafah border crossing. Maybe you can tell us if those are the ones or not. What are we looking at if that is going to happen? What types of preparations perhaps are taking place, or is there not much that Palestinians can do in order to avoid themselves being killed from Israeli soldiers firing on them?
Well, the Israeli forces, the Israeli occupation forces from the air, ground, and sea are still targeting the Palestinians, and I don't foresee anything that might be in the capacity of stopping or capable of stopping this thing unless the situation on the ground changes, and that change would be heavy ground attacks from the Palestinian resistance, heavy fire that is continuous from the Gaza Strip to the Palestine occupied 48. Now the Israelis are starting the first day of their ground, what they call ground activities, the localized sort of interventions in different areas to stop the launching rockets and to destroy the tunnels. And being technical now, I don't think that the statement that was made by the Israeli Prime Minister makes a great sense, because if you have the coordinates of the tunnels, if you have all the information, if you have the troops in the skies, if you have the troops on the ground, and if you have the artillery and the very precise GPS system, I don't think that anything would be impossible, including targeting the tunnels into the Palestinian territory. But technically, they don't have information about that network of tunnels, and they cannot do anything else to convince the Israeli audience that they are doing something to stop the fire. But I think by this, they are just worsening the situation. They're causing more fatalities among Palestinian civilians, and at the end of the day, they are not achieving the goal, at least the stated goal of their campaign. Given that, when I was waiting for the news bulletin, I could hear 5 Palestinian rockets flying from Gaza towards Palestine 48. This means that the rockets are still being launched, the resistance is still being active, and the ground incursion that Israel talks about might be causing some harm to the civilians, but is not causing a significant harm to the infrastructure and the networks of the Palestinian resistance.
Okay, and quickly, if you can, since you seem to be very much in tune, and it makes perfect sense, your deduction that what Israel has stated to be the aim of this operation, that's ruining the tunnels or destroying the tunnels, that they could do that given the coordinates from air. So what would be their purpose? Yes. Why would Israeli soldiers be given the green light to go into Gaza. I mean, what are they going to do? Aside from the fact that what we have seen is just people getting killed. And, of course, destruction of property. I mean, this is that going to increase? But at the same time, that's going to endanger the lives of Israeli soldiers.
This is one of the horror and shock and horror tactics that Israel uses against Palestinians. If you recall the images of the Palestinian civilians who were killed in the back into 22 days war in 2008, Israel couldn't stop the Palestinian rockets from falling into the Palestinian into Palestine occupied 48 for 22 days, and they still conducted some much more massive ground activities. They could cut the Gaza Strip into three separated geographical zones. They could also conduct some activities deep into the and very close to the Palestinian cities, and not only in Netzarim area but also in the Gaza middle zone. They were conducting those activities. At the end of the day, they withdrew from the Gaza Strip without achieving any goal whatsoever from the goals that were stated. The same scenario is being applied now in the Gaza Strip. Israel is aiming by this unleashed power to terrify the Palestinians, to increase the death toll among civilians, to make Palestinians and Hamas and all other Palestinian factions who are fighting against them believe that even if they are causing harm to the Israelis and even if they are returning fire, that Israel is still there and can make them suffer and can kill their families and destroy their homes. In the past few days, I would say in the 10 past days, Israel was not targeting significant military targets. They were trying to identify the whereabouts of the rockets, but they failed miserably to target those rockets. But they are still in those 10 days destroyed 400 houses and caused partial damages to 18,000 houses. So they know that they are not going to achieve the goals, but they are still stubborn enough to go into the territory and to lose. Because Netanyahu was also saying, and I'm quoting him here, that he's saying that there's no guarantee that this operation will be 100% successful, but they still might be very ready to the setbacks and be ready to some losses. So the bottom line that Israel is now doing this to make sure it can put some pressure on the Palestinians and bring them back to the negotiation table to accept the political conditions that were suggested and the deal that was suggested by a very strong ally of Israel, Mr. Assisi, and his allies in the area.
The BRICS summit ended with a declaration that lays out what may well be the foundation of a new world order on the horizon. Our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, has some of the details.
For outside observers, the interesting question is, to what extent are the current trends that have been put in place at this latest summit, which is by far the most, it's a massive advance in terms of the last 10 years for the countries concerned, because they've taken concrete steps to set up real structures. It's not just a talking shop. Mm-hmm. And they set up what they're calling the New Development Bank with $100 billion dollars of capital that provided equally by the five countries concerned. So they're hoping to overcome the problems that have beset the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank since their founding back at the end of the Second World War.
That's right.
In which the United States and its allies have had a dominant say.
Yeah, you said basically that this is the undoing, or some have been saying it's the undoing of Bretton Woods, or the successor to Bretton Woods.
Yeah, and if you what's the name of that guy, that Valentin Tatasanov? He wrote an article in Strategic Culture, the Russian English language website.
Yeah, I'm looking
in
at
which
it.
He said his argument is that what the Brazil meeting of the BRICS means is that Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa are saying to the United States and its allies, either you put in place what we agreed in 2010 as a redistribution of voting power in the IMF and the World Bank, or we're just going to do our own thing.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.